From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park Podcast.
Welcome to the August 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park Podcast. And peace at last. On the 15th of August 2025, the UK commemorated the 80th anniversary of VJ Day, the day on which the surrender of Japan and the end of World War II was announced. This was a significant moment at Bletchley Park, as it meant the end of almost 6 years of non-stop code breaking and intelligence work. For many, it also brought an abrupt halt to years of training to learn Japanese and long journeys to reach postings in India, Sri Lanka, and elsewhere in preparation for the upcoming invasion of Japan itself. In this It Happened Here episode, we're joined by Bletchley Park's historians Dr. Tom Cheatham and Dr. David Kenyon to discuss how the Japanese war ended and the part played by Bletchley Park and Signals Intelligence. Our thanks go to Owen Mugen and Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our historical documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, we've arrived at August 1945. We're nearing the end of the war. Can you give us an overview of the situation we find ourselves in?
Well, as we've discussed in this podcast before, the European war ended in May, but of course the war in the Far East, the war against Japan, continued. And after the various surrender documents with the Germans had been signed, there was a follow-up conference, the Potsdam Conference, which took place in the last 2 weeks of July in Potsdam in Germany, in Berlin. And this was an occasion for the leaders of the victorious powers in Europe to decide how they were going to divide the world amongst themselves, how they were going to sort out the future. And of course, one of the questions in that discussion is, what are we going to do about Japan? And one of the outcomes of the conference was the so-called Potsdam Declaration. And this was a public statement by the UK, the USA. It was also signed by China remotely, although their people weren't in Potsdam. And it basically called upon the Japanese to surrender or to stop fighting, come back to surrender, because it's slightly complicated in a minute. The Russians didn't sign the declaration, but that's because at this point, the Russians had never actually been at war with the Japanese. They actually have a non-aggression pact with the Japanese.
No, yeah.
The crux of the document is, and I can quote it here, "We call upon the government of Japan to proclaim now the unconditional surrender of all Japanese armed forces and to provide proper and adequate assurances of their good faith in such action. The alternative for Japan is prompt and utter destruction." And you can hear in that last sentence, there's a sort of, we know with hindsight, there's a threat of the atomic bombs. But as Tom will explain in a minute, there was already conventional bombing going on of Japan. And it's basically, you have to give up now or you pay the consequences.
It's during the Potsdam Conference that they actually carry out the Trinity test, which basically they're testing whether the atomic bomb's going to work, aren't they?
Yes. The Americans, at least, and the British know that the bomb is available. There are also further terms that are placed on the Japanese where they have to basically give up all their captured territory, the places they've conquered in the course of the war, their co-prosperity sphere, you know, their supposed empire. They also had to disarm their military. And there were clauses about basically having a more democratic system in Japan, you know, having an elected parliament and things like that. There's also a clause about war crimes trials. These had already happened with the Germans and the Italians. "Stern justice shall be meted out to all war criminals, including those who have visited cruelties upon our prisoners." And so there's a whole string of quite stringent conditions. It includes the occupation of Japan itself by Allied forces, et cetera, et cetera. What's interesting about the declaration is they don't address the issue that was kind of most important to the Japanese, which is the status of the emperor. The Japanese government certainly was adamant that the emperor needed to stay the emperor. Messing with the status of the emperor was kind of a non-negotiable thing.
Well, the Japanese people at this time saw the emperor as a living god, didn't they?
Yes, and particularly for the Japanese leadership other than the emperor, you know, getting rid of him would be kind of unthinkable. Interestingly, they don't communicate the declaration diplomatically directly to the Japanese. They just publish it in all the Western newspapers. They put it on the radio and they actually print leaflets with it on and they drop them over Japanese territory. So they make it known to everyone, but they don't actually say,
send it to them.
Send it to the government directly. And the Japanese are able, as a consequence, to, well, not ignore it, but not send a formal response because they haven't been approached formally diplomatically. They don't need to say anything. And they don't. They start having all sorts of internal discussions, but they don't give any overt reply. So that's the terms that have been laid out by the Allies. The next question is, what will the Japanese do about it?
In Potsdam, the Big Three conference continued with a business session held this Sunday afternoon. Big news about Japan is now being made and will shortly be revealed. There's almost no end to the speculation on what that news will prove to be. The guesses flow out of Washington and out of Potsdam, too. And Tokyo shows signs of curiosity. Yesterday, the Tokyo radio said that American public opinion would force President Truman to retreat from his demand for unconditional surrender.
There can be no peace in the world until the military power of Japan is destroyed. With the same completeness as was the power of the European dictators. To do that, we are now engaged in a process of deploying millions of our armed forces against Japan in a mass movement of troops and supplies and weapons over 14,000 miles, a military and naval feat unequaled in all history. Substantial portions of Japan's key industrial centers have been leveled to the ground in a series of record incendiary raids. What has already happened to Tokyo will happen to every Japanese city whose industries feed the Japanese war machine. If the Japanese insist on continuing resistance beyond the point of reason, their country will suffer the same destruction as Germany. Our blows will destroy their whole modern industrial plant and organization, which they have built up during the past century and which they are now devoting to a hopeless cause. We have no desire or intention to destroy or enslave the Japanese people, but only surrender can prevent the kind of ruin which they have seen come to Germany as a result of continued useless resistance.
Tom, David's given us an overview of where we were in July, August 1945, but can you focus in more in theatre for us?
Yes, so looking at events in the kind of western part of the theatre of war against the Japanese, not looking at the Pacific theatre, but looking at Burma, modern-day Myanmar, we heard in the last episode how Bill Slim's 14th Army had managed to push the Japanese out of Burma by the middle of the year. So they actually capture Rangoon at the start of May 1945, but they're still fighting in Burma up till early August, so quite close to the surrender. But they're planning to keep this going. They're not going to stop there because they're all working on the basis that the Japanese are going to keep fighting and the war's going to carry on, of course. So the next step in the plan would have been an operation called Operation Zipper. And this was going to carry the war back into Malaya. Thinking about the geography, you know, you've got Malaya kind of stretching down from Burma and Thailand all the way as an isthmus, all the way down until you get to Singapore at the bottom. And they're going to land about 100,000 troops on the west coast of Malaya in September 1945, is the plan. And then after they built up and presumably had, you know, some fighting with the Japanese forces in the area, they were going to break out north and south of their beachhead in around December. And they were hoping to liberate Malaya and also Singapore by about March 1946.
This is well planned then. Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of, reading about these plans, it does make you wonder about what might have happened had the war carried on and that there was this other timeline that could have unfolded where the war did drag on to possibly the middle of 1946 by the time they recaptured Singapore and obviously launched that invasion of the Japanese home islands, which is going to be inevitable sooner or later if the war carries on.
That's a huge landing force, 100,000. That's two-thirds of D-Day, isn't it?
Yeah, it would have been. Again, you've got the Allies now transferring all of those people from Europe and all those planes and tanks and ships. And it's a force the Japanese are never going to be able to resist for long, but it still would have taken another year or so to wrap the war up. What happens after VJ Day in this theatre is that they still carry out Operation Zipper because they're poised to launch it. And when the Japanese do surrender, it's the quickest way to get Allied troops back into those areas and secure them and reoccupy them and start to get them organised. So they carry out Operation Zipper in Malaya, and they carry out an operation called Tide Race to capture Singapore. And they were going in ready to fight as well, because there was a bit of doubt about whether the local Japanese forces would actually accept the directions of the Japanese government. And certainly some middle-ranking Japanese officers wished to carry on fighting. And they have 70,000 men in Singapore at this point, the Japanese.
Right.
So they could have gone on fighting and really caused problems. But in the end, they do surrender without a fight. And there are two major surrenders in Syria, a place called Penang in Malaya on the 2nd of September, and Singapore surrenders unofficially on the 4th of September, and then they have a formal surrender ceremony on the 12th of September. And while there's no resistance from the Japanese in a military sense, there are some mass suicides from soldiers and officers, especially who can't accept that they've lost the war. In one incident, 300 Japanese soldiers actually commit suicide in the Raffles Hotel in Singapore, which you can still visit to this day. Another interesting fact of these events as well is that one participant in the landings at Penang is HMS Petard, which we all know from the capture of the German short signal books in late 1942 that led to the breaking of course, the Shark U-boat key.
So there was a connection, lovely.
Yeah, Petard is the only British destroyer to sink a German, Italian and Japanese submarine in the war, and it ends its service out in the Far East as part of these operations. So it has a very, very successful career. And this basically wraps things up for that theatre of war. There's still a lot of work to do. There are problems on the ground with things like food distribution and the economy, because the Japanese occupation money suddenly becomes worthless and they have to sort the currency out. And there are issues like that, which mean that the authorities really have to get a grip on the situation to preserve law and order. Very quickly, obviously, after the war, Malaya will be, in its various different polities it's divided into, will be reorganized and become independent, as will Burma.
And now we're streaking in. You can hear our motor, the engine of this tank glider, roaring as we move quickly through the water up to a distance of about 2,000 yards from the shore. There's all hell to pay directly ahead of us. The beach looks as though it's practically on fire. The terrific roar around us is coming from mostly from our own amphibious tractors. There go American dive bombers going down on the beach, back of the beach. We can see the beach very clearly now. I'll tell you one thing, I'm thinking right now of my home, of my wife and my little daughter, and I hope they're all right. And I hope I come back to them all right. That's about what you think of now. I tried to get some of these men to talk, but I know deep down that's what they're thinking of. Oh, they're big Jap stuff dropping in the water up ahead of us a little. We'll probably have to go through it. There's great clouds of black smoke. There, we've hit it. We're grounding on it. We're up on it. We're up on it. In a minute, the ramp will go down, and then it's going to stream out. Man, Tom has just wished everybody good luck. Our machine gun just fired. Probably heard it. The men are now going out ahead. They're moving out ahead of the half track. Hey, spit out! Spit out!
Let's go back to Japan itself. How was it looking for the Japanese on the home islands?
Well, the noose is really tightening on Japan gradually throughout 1945. For much of the war, the Japanese home islands have been kind of invulnerable because of the distances in the Pacific. You can't fly a bomber from the US to bomb Japan the way you can fly one from Britain to bomb Germany. There was famously the Doolittle Raid, but, you know, it's a one-off. However, in late 1944, the US are conducting two kind of separate but parallel reinvasion operations. There's one in the sort of southeast, which is going through New Guinea and the Philippines, but there's also a separate arc which runs on the sort of northwestern side, which starts with the recapture of the Marianas Islands in 1944. And the significance of the Marianas, including Tinian, is that these are within bombing range of Japan. So you can put air bases on the Marianas and you will be able to bomb Japan directly. And at the same time, the Americans have rushed into production the B-29, the so-called Super Fortress, which has the range to do those operations, to fly and bomb Japan. So from late 1944 and into 1945, it becomes possible to attack Japan directly. Following on from that, you have in March 1945, the famous capture of Iwo Jima. We all know the photograph of the Marines raising the flag on Mount Suribachi and all of that. One of the advantages of Iwo Jima is it's kind of halfway between the Marianas and Japan. So it serves as an emergency landing ground for the bombers, but also it means that you can get long-range Mustang fighters, the P-51s, which had been developed to support the bombing offensive in Europe because they could fly all the way to Germany. They can be based on Iwo Jima and they can provide fighter cover for the Allied bombers over Japan. So basically, you have this increasing capability to attack the home islands directly, start bombing factories, start bombing cities, and really bringing destruction home to the Japanese in a way that hasn't happened up to that point in the war. The next step on is Okinawa, which is only 340 miles from Japan. And that was captured in June 1945.
And that's the last
sort of the last major, big island before you get to Japan proper, if you like, before you get to Honshu, which is a southern Japanese island. The feature of the Okinawa operation, though, is these invasions of these islands are taking place at ever-increasing cost to the US in resources and in manpower. The casualties from these operations are huge. The Japanese casualties are even more huge. I mean, the invasion of Okinawa, the Japanese lost 120,000 men. That's not killed, wounded, and captured. That's basically killed, because something like 94% of the garrison of Okinawa were killed because they didn't want to surrender. They just fought on and fought on and fought on, and the Americans just had to kill them because they wouldn't surrender. But what that means is the combats are very, very fierce, and the Japanese resistance is, on the one hand, it's crumbling because they don't have resources, they don't have the munitions, they're losing men, but the will to fight is definitely still there. Mm.
And that's only going to increase
as you get towards the Japanese home islands. So you have a bombing campaign which develops in ferocity as the year goes on. But at the same time, you have the realization by the Allied powers that the next step, if you like, is invasion of the Japanese home islands. And this is going to be an enormous operation. We spoke a little bit about this during the Haguro podcast a couple of months ago. Operation Downfall, as it's described, is actually planned to start in November, because it'll take that long to get to marshal the resources and get everybody together. The first invasion is in November. The second invasion is planned for January 1946. So the expectation is that the fight will go on for another 6 months to a year. And that's the picture we're looking at in August 45. Japan is being bombed very heavily. The Allied forces continue to creep across the Pacific Islands, both southeast and northwest. But everybody is bracing themselves for the big finale, if you like.
Good evening, everybody. This is Lyle Vann with the 11 o'clock report from the NBC newsroom. It was already the 4th of July in Japan when nearly 500 American superforts appeared overhead above industrial targets on Honshu and Shikoku Islands, carrying 3,000 tons of unfriendly fireworks for the enemy down below. Thus began Independence Day for the fighting crews of our giant bombers carrying the aerial offensive against the Mikado's imperial nest to a new high. War industries were the targets in this third all-out attack in 3 days. Meanwhile, the new invasion of Borneo at Balikpapan is going ahead, turning enemy airfields near the oil port into fighter bases for Allied aircraft, now near enough to attack Java, the heart of the Dutch East Indies. The Australian commander in the Balikpapan area says the campaign already is won strategically. Aussie troops are pressing northward, headed for the last Borneo oil field still in enemy hands. And over on Asia's mainland, victory is the underlying theme of the communiques issued by the Chinese High Command. Chungking reports that Chinese forces have dented the east flank of Japan's important Hong Kong-Hankou corridor when they captured the highway center of Sinfeng. Meanwhile, Tokyo is grinding out its usual propaganda broadcasts, declares that new Japanese fighter planes now being manufactured underground will soon take to the air to meet the B-29 menace. Then another broadcast says that the food situation is growing worse, tells the people to get set for a 10% cut in food rations until the fall harvest.
Now, we've looked at the theatres of operation. Let's come back to Buckinghamshire and Bletchley Park. Now, obviously, there's been a lot of changes at Bletchley Park since May, since the end of the German war. What are things looking like at Bletchley Park in this period?
So Bletchley Park started to contract, but it's still, there's a lot going on there. So I've crunched the numbers. People have heard on the podcast before, at its peak, which is January 1945, Bletchley Park has 8,995 staff. If we look at the closest return to VJ Day, which is the 12th of August 1945, we see the staff is still 5,871. So most people haven't been demobilised at this point. But obviously the picture varies depending on where you look at the organisation. So naturally the sections working on German traffic and German problems almost disappear. And those teams are kind of working on back traffic and wrapping things up. So if you look at the bomb section, for example, they start dismantling bombs from the 9th of June. Yep. They've still got 400 people working away at that problem. in August, but they've gone down from over 2,000 people to 492
in August. Yeah, that's a big change.
Again, the Newmanry goes from 327 to 73. Hut 6 and Hut 3 have 50 or 100 staff. The ISOS and ISK sections working on German intelligence agencies, they've gone down from 85 and 92 members, respectively, to 3 and 7.
3 and 7?
So they've basically been entirely demobilised.
So the people left are probably just doing the histories, aren't they?
They're pretty much. Quite often the second-in-commands staying to write up some of those documents, yeah. You wonder if that 7 probably includes Beatty, Beatty, Rock and Twin, who are writing their history of work on the German intelligence machine ciphers, which is the document we have on display here. On the other hand, some sections have only contracted in quite a modest way or stay pretty similar. So if you look at Barclay Street, where they're doing the diplomatic work, 337 people, they're only down to 322. You've still got 500 people on administration based on 700 in January. Communications, the cipher office doing all the encipherment and decipherment of material coming in and out, it's gone down from 442 to 281. So they're still keeping these people pretty busy. And naturally, they don't have to deal with communications out to Germany, but you've still got a huge job of communicating with the signals intelligence agencies in the US and in the Far East. And some sections stay the same. Naval section stays pretty much the same size, just under 1,100 people. During this period, air section, weirdly, at Bletchley Park actually gets a lot bigger. It goes up from 310 in the records to 897. But that's because they've reorganised it, basically, and they set up in 1944 a section called Japanese Forces, or JAFO for short, and that includes lots of Air Force personnel, but also Army personnel working on Japanese. And after the end of the German War, all of these personnel are incorporated into what they call the air section. So you have that administrative quirk where one part of the organisation seems to get a lot bigger. But the reason the naval section stays the same size as all the staff pretty much working on German are transferred straight across to Japanese. They don't really let anyone go. And I think this might be the only time in the war, actually, that Bletchley Park has enough staff to do everything that needs to be done. Or they're basically satisfied with the number of people they have because they've spent the entire war screaming for more reinforcements because there's always too much work and not enough people. But they suddenly have all those German staff to use. And they can transfer them straight across and they can work on Japanese because they don't really need to learn the language in most cases, these people. They're moving across to the same sort of production line work that they were doing on the German ciphers. So the language skills aren't a huge problem and they can keep those people around until they're ready to demobilize them. So the idea, you know, that Bletchley Park shuts up shop after VE Day and a minority stay working on Japanese, that's not really accurate.
No.
Most people are still here. The problem the leadership have now is not so much about resources, but just about how they manage everything that's going on, because they are having to juggle continuing to fight the war and preparing for the post-war world at the same time. A lot of those preparations have been going on for a while, since mid-1944. So it's in August 1944 when they put the word out to civilian staff and say, are you interested in staying on in this work after the end of hostilities?
Oh, really? That early?
Yeah, so they've been laying down the groundwork for demobilisation for a while. And what's interesting is that GCNCS by this point has kind of gained control over its own affairs. It's kind of managed to free itself from oversight, from MI6, from the different armed services, from the Foreign Office, and is finally at a point where it can kind of do what it wants. But then, as soon as peace rears its head, all of a sudden, those external relationships become really important again. They're having to work out how they demobilise staff according to the regulations. They're having to have negotiations with the Treasury about how much money they're going to get in peacetime. All of these issues come up, which hadn't been problems before. There are so many unanswered questions about where the organisation is going to work and how it's going to be organised. And you see all this evidence in the archives. They're thinking about, for example, when they decide to move most of the staff to Eastcote, which had been the big bomb out station in North London. You've got files of underground timetables that they're checking to make sure the staff are going to be able to get to work on time.
Oh, really?
So it's the devil's in the detail of all these arrangements that they're having to make. And of course, a big unanswered question is how is the relationship with the Americans going to look as well? And we've talked about that on the podcast plenty of times. So demobilisation is going to create, and it's already creating, lots of knotty new administrative problems that's happening at the same time as they're still having to fight the war. And that's really putting everyone under a lot of pressure at the top end. We have some really good evidence for this in a letter that Edward Travis wrote to Joseph Wenger, who is his counterpart at OP 20G, which is the US Naval Code-Breaking Organization. He's really writing to report back on how one particular US liaison officer is performing at Bletchley Park.
Right.
But he starts off with quite a long gripe about how the current state of affairs with the administration is really starting to wear him down.
Dear Wenger, I am afraid it is some time since I last wrote to you. My excuse, as you can imagine, is that the various complicated problems which have arisen since VE Day still show no signs of disappearing. In fact, they seem to increase as days go by. I expect we shall have to deal with even more problems in the near future, in view of the imminent conclusion of the Japanese War, and I am taking this opportunity to write you a few lines before the inevitable confusion is among us. Since my return to the UK, the most aggravating factors have been, as usual, those outside our own control. Government demobilization schemes, uncertainty about our post-war establishment, the question of the future locality of the park, and a host of similar difficulties. But I need not enlarge. You're bound to be meeting similar problems yourself at the moment, and I'm sure you know only too well the frustrating effect of such difficulties when they all occur together.
Tom's just explained to us how things were looking at Bletchley Park in this period, but the code-breaking is not just carried out in a mansion in Buckinghamshire. It's happening everywhere, isn't it? So can you explain to us what's happening closer to the action?
I can, and the picture is very similar to what Tom has described of resources becoming available for the Japanese problem and a build-up of those resources because, as I said earlier, there is this expectation that the war with Japan is going to get really intensive in the rest of 1945 and in the early part of 1946. So we spoke some time ago, but the Government Code and Cipher School has two kind of remote operations in South Asia. There's the Wireless Experimental Centre in Delhi, which is an Army and Air Force operation principally. And then you have the Far East Combined Bureau, which is the naval side of the code-breaking operation. That had originally been in Singapore and then in Colombo and then in Mombasa. By now it's back in Colombo, yeah. HMS Anderson. And HMS Anderson in particular grows substantially after VE Day. There are a whole tranche of staff who are sent to Sri Lanka.
We've had so many of our veterans' testimonies talking about this, haven't we?
Yes, you see a significant number of Wrens, of whom we have testimony, who do their sort of Bletchley Park thing. They're in naval section or they're bomb operators or whatever. And then suddenly in late 44 and in spring of 45, they're told, you're going to India. But it's not just more junior staff. Hugh Alexander, who we think of as head of Hut 8 and a crucial figure in Enigma, and Naval Enigma in particular, he's running that operation until August 1944. In August 1944, he is moved over to JN-25, which is the Japanese naval cipher system, and he works on that at Bletchley Park. And then after VE Day, after the defeat of the Germans, Hugh Alexander is actually sent to Colombo to HMS Anderson.
Really?
To carry on doing Japanese work over there. So he's a figure we really think of as an Enigma man. So it's not just Wrens and junior staff are being sent, but senior figures are also being co-opted into this.
I didn't know that at all. I'm really surprised. That's the first time I've ever heard that.
Yeah, I mean, it came as a bit of a surprise to me. The discussion of how to expand HMS Anderson has been going on through 1944 because they were aware of the build-up against Japan. But also, and we talked a little bit about this when we were talking about the sinking of the Higuro, there's a tension between British ambitions in the Pacific and American domination of that theatre and building up HMS Anderson and making a real contribution to JN-25 and to Japanese codebreaking is important for that SIGINT diplomatic relationship and for Britain's role in that part of the war. So a number of plans are drawn up to expand HMS Anderson from just over 1,000 people to nearer 2,000 people, from 1,200 to 1,700. And this included another 300 Wrens in one of the... There were various plans drawn up of various scales of expansion. The problem they had was by October 44, they'd only managed to find 32 Wrens to send, so it wasn't going very well.
Was that voluntary at the time then? Or
I think it's sort of semi-voluntary. And the testimony is that most people, when they're asked, they seem to say yes. One of the issues is that the vice chief of the naval staff, who is ultimately responsible for naval personnel, basically says that you can't send any more naval personnel east until the Germans have been beaten. So until VE Day, no one is available. So you see this big spike in Wrens moving east after May. Once the Germans have been beaten, the Navy is persuaded that these people are now spare and can now go. And if you look at HMS Anderson, the strength of HMS Anderson in July 1944 is 876. Its strength in August 1945 is 1,576. So nearly double. And that includes 615 wrens.
Oh, so the vast majority of that increase is just wrens then?
Well, that includes some of the wrens that have been there all along.
Oh, right, okay.
But a good 300 of those are new wrens. So there's a huge expansion, both in the Japanese operation at Bletchley Park, as Tom was describing, and in the on-the-ground, in-theatre operations in India and Sri Lanka.
This was the final lap of the long mission, to return a visit that had been paid to Pearl Harbor 3 years before. There were other things on their minds. There was the triumphant feeling of being the first, the advance guard of a long procession of super forts that would smash Tokyo. There was the grim satisfaction of making the Nipponese High Command eat its words. Tokyo, the Japanese High Command had broadcast, is out of range of land-based American bombers. 1,600 miles lay between them and their target. 1,600 miles lay between the target and getting back to Saipan. How many of them would get back? 6 hours later, through the clouds, they saw it. Fujiyama, ancient symbol of Japan. Now, below them is Tokyo. In the suburbs of Tokyo is the huge Nakajima aircraft plant. Of the B-29s that had taken off at dawn, all but two got back to Saipan that night.
Tom, at the start of the podcast, David was explaining about the Potsdam Conference. Now, what literally followed on from that? Because this big declaration is made, you have to surrender or else.
Well, what follows on from this is silence, because the Japanese don't respond to the declaration. There are obviously various discussions of it. It's picked up. It's not presented as an official communique to the Japanese government, because that would be considered a peace treaty, or that could be interpreted as peace negotiations being opened.
Yeah.
But it is communicated to them by other channels. And the Japanese government opinions obviously vary, but basically the consensus is that the declaration will have to be accepted and that surrender is going to be effectively inevitable. But they are hoping that there will be time to clarify the terms of a surrender, and they hope to do that with the Soviets, who have yet to join the war against Japan. Because there are these unanswered questions, there are these ambiguities in the document. In particular, the declaration talks about removing the authority and influence of those who have deceived and misled the people of Japan into embarking on world conquest. And the question is, does that include the emperor or not? Because that's the big constitutional issue for the Japanese. And it's this silence which is interpreted by the American government as justification to enact the prompt and utter destruction which they'd promised in the declaration.
At this point, I mean, we're not just talking about the atom bomb. They've already been doing this with conventional bombing, haven't they?
Yeah, so that's the fact here, is that the atomic bombs are not the only weapon in the Allied arsenal. And they're by no means the most destructive. It's ironic to say so, but they're by no means the most destructive weapon in their arsenal either, because an atomic bomb can do obviously a huge amount of damage. But most Japanese people killed and wounded in bombing attacks have already been killed and wounded in firebombing raids. The Allies have been bombing Japan, but they've been carrying out pretty ineffective sort of precision raiding. And from early 1945, they really start to turn the screw on the Japanese in terms of just doing mass firebombing, using incendiary weapons. They are aware these attacks will be effective on kind of large Japanese cities, mostly constructed out of wood. And the effect of these raids is absolutely catastrophic. The single most destructive air attack in history is carried out in this period on the 9th and 10th of March 1945, known as Operation Meeting House, and it's a raid on Tokyo. It kills at least 80,000 people in a single night and displaces a million people and raises a very large proportion of the city. And they are repeating this trick against every major Japanese city until June 1945. Those other attacks kill about 126,000. And some of those cities are being 98% destroyed. So the level of destruction is beyond anything really seen in Europe, where even the heaviest hit German cities are maybe 80% destroyed.
They're beginning to run out of targets, aren't they, I think?
They are. So in about June, they decide to actually shift their attacks onto smaller cities because they think that the big cities are really done for. And it's really very, very one-sided. The amount of opposition the Japanese are able to put up in terms of anti-air and fighter defence is negligible. Many of these raids are effectively unopposed. And the Japanese air forces are actually saving their aircraft strength to resist a land invasion. So they're not really putting up much resistance at this point. So what we see is that most Japanese casualties of bombing are caused during this period in early 1945, before the nuclear weapons are even ready. And it's worth noting that even without the two atom bombs, had the Japanese continued to ignore the declaration and refused to surrender, the firebombing campaign would have been restarted. And it is restarted, actually, just for a couple of days, right at the end of the war, just before the Japanese surrender. They do restart conventional strategic bombing as well. So that would have led to, if not the end of the war, then the collapse of the Japanese economy and potentially Japanese society without ever having to use the nuclear weapons.
We interrupt our program to take you to Washington.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. We are now prepared to destroy, more rapidly and completely, every productive enterprise the Japanese have in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake. We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July the 26th was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen, and with the fighting skill of which they are already well aware.
David, is there any specific SIGIN associated with the atomic bombs?
There is, yes. The Allies have been breaking a whole series of different Japanese code and cipher systems. I alluded to JN-25, which is the naval cipher. Arguably the most famous and possibly most important other system is PURPLE. This is the Japanese diplomatic cipher machine that was broken back in 1940. We've talked in the past about General Oshima, who is the Japanese ambassador in Berlin, and he's close with Hitler and the intelligence prior to D-Day and all of those things. That's all coming from PURPLE. The cipher machine is codenamed PURPLE. The traffic is actually codenamed by the US MAGIC. So you hear the term MAGIC, and that refers to high-grade diplomatic traffic. In America, it's MAGIC. When it arrives in the UK, it becomes ULTRA. It falls under that classification because it's high-grade traffic. But why this is important with the atomic bombs is that, obviously, the bomb project has been very secret. Nobody knows what it is or what it does. The Japanese have actually had their own atomic bomb program. Well, actually, they had two. The Army had one and the Navy had one. But they hadn't got very far. But they knew enough to know that this was a theoretical concept. And when the first bomb is dropped, obviously, that fact is publicly reported. Truman makes a statement about it. But the Japanese don't know what's going on. It comes obviously as a surprise to them. And more importantly, the Japanese have diplomatic posts around the world. And already since Potsdam, the Japanese are trying to figure out their negotiating position with the Allies. Because although some parts of the Japanese government and military never want to surrender, there are other parts of the Japanese government going, this is probably inevitable.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can get the best deal. You know, how are we going to negotiate? So after the bomb is dropped, you have Japanese diplomats overseas going, we've read about this in the papers. What the hell's going on? Can you tell us what's happening so that we know how to respond diplomatically? We want to know how to move forward. And in particular, there's a couple of pieces of traffic which talk about this specific question. The first is a request by the naval attaché in Stockholm. Stockholm is important because it's one of the channels through which the Japanese talk to the UK. Their mission in Stockholm in Sweden, which is a neutral country, they're able to talk to the British Embassy in Stockholm. And you know, that's a channel of communication. So for the naval attaché in Stockholm to know what's happening is important. He sends a message to Tokyo, basically asking what's going on.
From naval attaché in Sweden to chief of the 3rd Section of Naval General Staff, 08/07/16/40/I, 1945. The announcement by the President of the United States and the Secretary of War of the perfecting of an atomic bomb using uranium as its basic material has created a great sensation throughout the entire world. We believe they are using a number of powerful bombs and giving out propaganda as though the atomic bomb were actually ready, as a stratagem to cause us to lose our will to fight. If there are no objections, we would like to know the facts about the situation wherein the enemy claimed they used the said bomb against Hiroshima.
A feature of these purple decrypts is many of them are made in the USA. The actual decryptions take place in the USA, and then the material is shared by teleprinter or by cable with the UK. So these aren't necessarily messages that have been broken at Bletchley Park itself, but they are, thanks to the Brucer circuit and all the collaboration between the UK and USA that we've talked about, this material is being shared with the British government so they know what's going on as well. The reply from the Bureau of Military Affairs at the Japanese Foreign Ministry to Stockholm, we also have record of that intercept. I would warn listeners that this is quite a graphic document. A reply is sent to diplomatic outposts which gives quite horrific detail of what had actually happened at Hiroshima.
Effect of the bomb blast. Within 500 meters, human intestines were laid bare and eyeballs pulled out. And even at 2,000 meters, there were deaths from the bomb concussion. Within 2 kilometers, bodies were stark naked. There were deaths from burns and wooden constructions were totally destroyed. Wood constructions within 4 kilometers were half destroyed. Almost everyone within 4 kilometers suffered burns, but even at 7 kilometers, slight burns were received. The majority of these were only on the side that was exposed to the flash of the explosion in the parts exposed to the high radiation temperature. The effect on vegetation was comparable to that for human beings. Even around 7 kilometers, parts of the branches and leaves has withered.
We can see from that message that, you know, it's grim stuff. The Japanese aren't holding back on letting people...
No, and they're also fully aware of what's happened to them, aren't they? It's not like we've no idea what on earth this thing was. They've got a pretty good idea, haven't they?
They have got a pretty good idea. Interestingly, previously, some of the more sort of hawkish Japanese diplomats overseas had tried to argue that it was a hoax. So I think this message is partly for their benefit going, no, this is definitely not a hoax. Right, this stuff happened. And there's also a following message, not a diplomatic message, a naval message using JN-25, the fleet code. And this is sent to various naval bases. And what it's saying is you need to be prepared for more atomic bombs. The problem is the instructions they give in terms of air raid precautions are insignificant because they're kind of saying people shouldn't come out of their shelters immediately after an aircraft has passed over. They should wait for a few minutes because with the atomic bombs, they basically come down on a parachute. And they take a while to go off. But the precautions they're offering are so insignificant in comparison to the damage the bomb would do. It's kind of a sticking plaster for a gaping wound. But it's clear that the Japanese Navy is trying to do something and trying to reassure people that, you know, there are things you can do, even though there really aren't.
Section 2. Present estimates of damage. About 80% of the city was wiped out, destroyed, or burned. Only a portion of the west section of the town escaped the disaster. Casualties have been estimated at 100,000 persons. Section 3. Relief squads have been dispatched to the area to assist the No. 2 General Army in rescue operations. About 1,000 Army troops and 10,000 medical supplies were moved in by dawn on the 7th. Section 4. Impressions. Possibility of damage even though not in the actual vicinity of the expected raid. Number 1. Precautionary measures, sounding of early precautionary alerts and air raid warnings. Number 2. Unreadable. Number 3. Policy of not securing from air raid alerts immediately after the enemy planes pass over. Number 4. Stock up on medical supplies for treatments of burns. Number 5. Set up equipment to power facilities. Please investigate and report any information concerning this new type of bomb.
Following on from this, after both bombs have fallen, there is more discussion in the Japanese government about they should open negotiations with the Allies, that they should think about giving up or surrendering. They try and avoid using the term surrender. They always describe it as complying with the terms of the Potsdam Declaration.
Right, okay.
They don't like the S word. And there's quite an interesting diplomatic summary. Bletchley Park is taking this ultra traffic and the JN-25 and everything else, and Japanese diplomatic section are producing summaries of the traffic. So there's a sort of report on two or three days of traffic. And there's one produced on the 13th of August, which goes right back to basically the 9th and 10th after the second bomb has been dropped. It summarizes all the back and forth between the Japanese and their various delegations. I talked about some of these more hawkish diplomats overseas. One of those overseas legations, interestingly, the naval attaché in Stockholm, who would be the one we've talked about responsible for dealing with the UK, he actually suggested that rather than surrendering, they should kill a lot of Allied prisoners of war as a reprisal for the bombing.
Right, okay.
Would probably have been quite counterproductive.
Doubling down at this point.
Yeah, they are kind of doubling down at this point. There's also, it's not very important, but it's a sort of weird aside, which is the messages from Dublin described in the summary suggesting that President Roosevelt, who had died, had actually committed suicide, or even that he wasn't dead at all. This basically stems from Soviet paranoia.
Right.
Stalin didn't trust the Allies at all. And a rumor has surfaced in the USSR that the Allies are planning to renege on all the promises they made to Stalin at Yalta about the division of Europe and the post-war world. And Roosevelt was so upset by this betrayal of the Soviets that he's taken his own life. We've talked about this in the past, but it shows just how mad and paranoid the Soviet government and Stalin are. You know, everything the Allies do is a trick. But the fact that this has filtered through to Japanese diplomats in Dublin.
They've got more important things to be worrying about at this point in time.
They have. I mean, it goes so far as apparently the Soviets had instructed their diplomats in Washington, D.C. to ask to see Roosevelt's body to prove that he was dead. It's not really to do with VJ Day, but it's an interesting aside on the whole situation. Finally, on the 14th, as we'll talk about in a minute, the Japanese decide to surrender, and they sent messages to their diplomatic legations, including what the emperor was going to say and the terms of their surrender and everything else. So when the Japanese finally do surrender, it's not a complete surprise to the Allies because they've seen the diplomatic traffic already.
And where do they send these messages?
They go to the various legations around the world. In particular, Bern in Switzerland is the channel they use to communicate with the Americans. And as I said, Stockholm in Sweden is the channel they use to communicate with the UK.
At the time of the explosion, we were wearing Polaroid welder's glasses. They were so dark that even the tropical sun showed through them as nothing more than a vague pinpoint of light. Even then, the explosion, when eventually it came, was so bright that it had the same effect as if night had been turned into day. A few seconds later, when it was safe to take off our glasses, we looked out towards the target and saw a vast ball of fire. It was about 2,000 feet in the air and half a mile in diameter. This fire, which generated almost 10 million degrees of heat, began rocketing up into the heavens at a speed of something like 20,000 feet a minute. After 15 seconds, the flame had died out and turned into a cloud. Exactly what that cloud looked like, I do not suppose any words will ever describe. Unlike any other phenomenon the world has ever seen, it was possessed of some diabolical activity, as though it were a horrible form of life. Its heat was so great that even at a range of 20 miles, we could see the dust from the earth being sucked up into the air like a vortex. The cloud rose to a height of 60,000 feet in less than 5 minutes, and there it stayed. On flying close to it, we saw that its color was a sort of luminous yellow, like sulfur. Throughout the whole time, it remained a boiling, turbulent mass and continued expanding until it reached some 2 miles across. We knew from what we had been told that its activity would destroy anything that came within its reach, and therefore we stayed out of range some 5 or 6 miles away.
Now, David, you spoke about all the different diplomatic messages that were going around, and that finally the Japanese did surrender. So how did they actually surrender?
Well, events moved quite quickly between the dropping of the second bomb on 9th of August and 14th of August when they make this decision to surrender. One of the crucial ingredients in the mix, which we haven't really talked about yet, is that since 1941, the Japanese have had a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. They have competing strategic interests, Manchuria, which has been occupied by the Japanese since the 1930s. The Russians are interested in Manchuria. Stalin has an eye to getting his seat at the table when Japan does surrender, because being neutral, he wouldn't have had a role in the peace terms imposed on Japan. So on 9th of August, as previously agreed with the Western allies at Yalta, Stalin tore up the treaty and declared war on the Japanese. I mean, the Japanese were kind of expecting it, but it just adds to their burdens, really. It's yet another problem that they can't deal with. I mean, they have history in this. I mean, our more historically astute listeners will know that the Japanese and the Russians fought a war in Manchuria back in 1904, 1905, the Russo-Japanese War. Those issues of Port Arthur and all that have never really gone away. And there are islands that to this day are Russian rather than Japanese because of the peace treaty after the Russo-Japanese War. So Soviet troops cross the border into Manchuria, and this is a real blow for the Japanese government because one of their backup plans was they thought they had a friend in Stalin who could be their sort of go-between between them and the US and UK and China, and that they would have a sort of someone who could negotiate on their behalf. Right. But once Stalin declares war on them, that option disappears.
Yeah. Things are getting desperate if you
things are getting desperate
relying on and Uncle Joe.
Stalin, actually, one of the things he has his eye on is he wants to participate in the invasion of Japan for strategic, geopolitical reasons. Because, I mean, there is a suggestion, because obviously we remember that Berlin had a French zone, a British zone, a Russian zone, and an American zone. He was assuming that there would be zones in Tokyo and that the Soviets could have an occupation zone in Tokyo. The idea that the occupation force would come from the Western Allies wasn't something that Stalin particularly wanted.
No.
Getting his boots on the ground, both in China and in Japan and the Japanese islands, would have been really good for him. So that's a massive blow to the Japanese government. The other problem they have is, as Tom has described, they are being bombed into oblivion at this point. They're not only atomic bomb raids, but massive conventional bombing raids, which continue after 9th of August. Their food supplies are collapsing. The population is starting to starve because their merchant fleets have been destroyed. They're not getting any food imports or anything else. There is a genuine fear in the government that there will be a popular uprising. There will be disorder on the streets, which they can't do anything about. So all of these factors come together in persuading them on the 14th of August that they just have to surrender, or they have to agree to the terms of the Potsdam Declaration. The way this is done is that at noon Japanese time, on the 15th of August, the voice of the emperor is broadcast on the radio in Japan, and he explains that the war is going to end, that they're going to stop fighting, they're going to surrender. It's not the emperor speaking live. What they did was they recorded the emperor onto a gramophone record the previous day on the 14th. Things get a bit crazy because on the 13th and 14th, a portion of the Japanese army try and stage a military coup in order to take over the government and carry on the war. There's a sort of hardcore hawkish faction. And they get into the imperial palace, and their mission is to find and smash the phonograph record of the emperor. They don't want this broadcast to be made. But fortunately, the sort of the Japanese equivalent of the BBC, their sort of government wireless service people who have made the recording, manage to hide in the basement of the palace, and they're not found, and the coup is suppressed. And so on the following day, Japanese citizens hear the voice of the emperor on the radio. And this is completely unprecedented. He's never spoken in public before. His voice is only heard by his immediate circle. So to hear him speaking is baffling to a lot of people. And a lot of people find it very frightening and very weird because there's an announcement beforehand that the emperor is going to speak. And some Japanese people actually go home and they put on their best suits, their poshest clothes, so they can be suitably dressed to listen to the emperor. And so it's a massively big deal for the Japanese population. The problem they have is the recording is awful. We can play a bit of the recording and you'll hear just how awful it is. Also, he speaks classical Japanese. Imperial Japanese has parted company with normal colloquial Japanese many years before. So a lot of what the emperor is saying, the Japanese people don't understand anyway. So it's completely shocking. Again, the Japanese don't convey their surrender diplomatically. Rather, as the Allies hadn't directly conveyed Potsdam, the Japanese don't sort of directly convey in the other direction. They simply broadcast this on radio, and then subsequently they broadcast an English language version. And I suppose you could call it SIGINT, but one of the sort of the last intercepts, is, if you like, is that the English language version is actually picked up in the USA and recorded and taken down. The FCC in the United States capture it.
It was hard to keep up the frantic pitch of war fever after V-Day, but the Japanese were still fighting in the Far East. Their messages still needed attention, so our section carried on working as before. It was August when we heard that the Allies had dropped an atom bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Within hours, someone on our unit noted that in some signal, the Japanese had used a hitherto unrecorded phrase, which was Genchi Bakudan. This means, quite literally, and unsurprisingly, atom bomb. So that was one new entry for our technical dictionary. Then, a short while later, there was a second Genchi Bakudan that wiped out the city of Nagasaki. The Divine Emperor made a public speech for the first time in his life. The entire Japanese nation, overcome with shock, sat with their ears glued to their radio sets, listening with difficulty to the unfamiliar and barely intelligible formal court diction used by their living god. They learned that the war had taken a turn that was not necessarily to Japan's advantage. It was all over. In retrospect, Bletchley did not seem to us at the time to be at all strange. Once we had experienced a few weeks of initiation, it very soon became part of our lives. It was normality itself, and it seemed as if it was set to go on forever. What was unnerving was when everything stopped so abruptly. It was the world outside, to which we now had to adapt, that was strange and foreign. It felt as if part of our own being had suddenly died, and the mental shock was probably akin to that experienced by a hospital patient following an amputation.
From the memoir of Eric Hugh Norris, RNVR, Japanese Naval Section.
It takes some time after that to organise the official surrender signing event, and that actually happens on the 2nd of September. And if you go to the US, their equivalent of VJ Day is actually the 2nd of September, not the 15th of August. Okay. In the UK, we celebrate the surrender broadcast day. That was VJ Day in the UK. The Americans waited until the instrument of surrender was signed. That took place in an enormous ceremony in Tokyo Bay on board the US battleship Missouri. There's literally hundreds of Allied warships there. The British are represented by a number of warships. The Americans have a huge fleet. It's an enormous show of strength. There's the flypast by something like 800 American aircraft. And it's a real public statement, and it's filmed, and it's in the papers and everything else, saying to the domestic population in America, we've won, but also making that point very forcefully to Japanese. And a Japanese delegation come on board, and General MacArthur is there to sign an instrument of surrender. On the British side, a man we've spoken about before, amongst other things during the sinking of the Scharnhorst, Admiral Fraser, who is now Commander East, the British Pacific Fleet, he signs on behalf of the UK. So he's the British representative at this event. An interesting footnote to this, and I didn't realise this until I was looking into it recently, the surrender document is not a formal peace treaty. And because the emperor stays in post and the Japanese government continues, it's not like Germany where the government was basically abolished by the surrender. The Japanese government continues to exist. And although they've made an act of military surrender, they haven't made a treaty of peace with the Western allies.
Right, okay.
So actually the war formally is only finished with the Treaty of San Francisco, which is signed in September 1951.
51. Okay.
Yeah, this is the document that actually sets up the post-war relationship between the Western Allies and modern Japan, effectively, and the occupation is formally ended and everything else. But it struck me, I was interesting, I didn't know that it took till 1951 to actually do that. And the other aspect of this is that the USSR, who had declared war on Japan on 9th of August, and they had a military campaign that lasted 4 days until the Japanese surrendered, that war didn't actually come to an end until 1956, when the Soviet Union signed an agreement with the Japanese government. So a war that involved about less than a week of fighting actually took 11 years to get a peace treaty. But yes, from our perspective, the most significant moment, obviously, is the Emperor's broadcast on the 15th of August, which brought hostilities to a close and is commemorated as VJ Day.
Now General Douglas MacArthur appears, accompanied by high-ranking officers of the United States Army. This day is the culmination of their work.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. As Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, I announce it my firm purpose, in the tradition of the countries I represent, to proceed in the discharge of my responsibilities with justice and tolerance while taking all necessary dispositions to ensure that the terms of surrender are fully, promptly, and faithfully complied with. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated. Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.